The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will come to order. This hearing deals with the conflict and climate change are driving our global security issues, so I want to thank our witnesses for this food security hearing. Today, more people are desperate to find the next meal. More families are choosing to migrate in search of food. More children are going to sleep hungry. According to the World Food Program, 47 million people are living on the edge of famine, and 333 million are facing crisis levels of hunger. In recent years, food insecurity has been at its highest level since World War II. This is not isolated to one country or one continent. From Burma to Ukraine, from Haiti to Syria, conflict and violence keep people from getting enough to eat. The humanitarian crisis in Gaza is dire and getting worse. I've said this before, we need to be more aid to the innocent Palestinians. We need to deliver it safely and quickly. I welcome the administration and our allies taking new steps to alleviate suffering through airdrops, but airdrops alone are simply not enough. Of course, it's not just war that's creating this global crisis. The effects of climate change are devastating the world's food supply. Fresh water and cultivable lands are scarcer, and they are fewer in recent years. Extreme weather events like the severe flooding we saw in Pakistan in 2022 have destroyed millions of acres of farmland around the globe. We cannot isolate ourselves from this crisis. And yet, last year, the World Food Program faced a 60% funding shortfall, the largest in its history. I want to thank Senator Coons, who is continuously bringing these attentions to all of us, the need for additional resources. And he has an incredibly difficult challenge, considering the limits that have been placed on the appropriation bill that he is the chair of. And I thank him again for his advocacy on behalf of these issues. This shortfall has meant cutting food rations in the most desperate places in the world. And when people go hungry, instability often follows. I believe strongly, as many of my colleagues in both parties do as well, that food security is a human right. It is important as democratic governance in preserving stability and security. That is why it is in U.S. national security interest to solve the climate crisis. I am pleased that the Biden administration has made food security a priority. It is critical we support programs like Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative, and the vision for adapted crops and soils. We need to incorporate state-of-the-art forecasting data to understand threats and changes to food security. Our nation must continue to take the leadership role, which is why it is critical we get the supplemental security funding passed, including food assistance for millions of people. The supplemental includes so many important areas, but one of the most important areas is the humanitarian assistance that was included in the supplemental that passed the Senate. Across the American political divide, you can see an interest in stepping up with critical food aid. But even as we race to get people food before they go hungry, we must recognize that solving the global food insecurity means making serious long-term investments, strengthening food systems and resilience of growers around the world, getting American-generated climate models and forecasts to communities in the global South so they can plan for the changing environment, helping America's land-grant universities and agricultural research centers playing a larger role, and working with the international community to take up innovation and accelerate approaches that we know work. Thanks to the generosity of American farmers, we are saving lives around the world. I believe American action will inspire other nations and the international community to do more. We all must do more. So I want to thank our witnesses for appearing before us today to give us their valuable help in what we can do to alleviate this crisis. I hope that you can give us the insight on how to best tackle this problem. It's now my pleasure to recognize the distinguished ranking member, Senator Risch.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for those kind remarks. And I, too, would want to recognize the good work that Senator Coons is doing in this area. Our last hearing on global food security was in July 2022. 5 months after Putin began his brutal war against Ukraine and his attempt to starve the world into submission. Despite strong efforts to combat this, the overall state of global food insecurity has not improved. 783 million people around the globe suffer from food shortage. 333 million people are facing acute food insecurity. An estimated 47 million people are on the brink of famine. These aren't just statistics. These are actual people. Congress appropriates billions of dollars annually to respond to emergencies through life-saving programs, including Food for Peace and Emergency Food Security Program. This money also supports initiatives to help communities grow their own way out of poverty and become more resilient to food shocks like Russia's war in Ukraine, price spikes, COVID, earthquakes, and hurricanes. These are important programs that we are currently operating. Unfortunately, we spend too much time fighting to resource these programs and too little time on maximizing their impact. For example, nearly 70 years of Food for Peace, after nearly 70 years of Food for Peace, we still can't decide its principal purpose. Is it to feed hungry people or to ensure that one U.S. company operating the three bulk carriers available for U.S. food aid deliveries has a big enough subsidy? The inability or unwillingness to resolve this leads to higher costs and lower impact. It also drives well-intentioned advocates to push new legislative ideas or workarounds that only add more layers of bureaucracy and undermine efficiency. Let's be clear. Congress will never appropriate its way out of this current global food security crisis. We need to do better with what we've got. First and foremost, countries receiving aid must do more to address the drivers of food insecurity within their own borders. This includes resolving conflicts, governing justly, combating corruption, and removing the barriers that impede economic growth and trade. Humanitarian groups also need to do their part, and they need to improve targeting and oversight so they can ensure aid is getting where it is needed. They must do more to protect aid from being diverted by armed groups, criminals, governments, or the implementers themselves. Wide-scale adoption of technology that can improve targeting and verification, including biometrics, is long overdue. On the development side, we need to work more closely with the private sector to bring innovations to scale. I recently saw an Idaho-based company, Semilla Nueva, won a USAID grant to enhance the quality and adoption of biofortified maize in Latin America. We should see more of this type of collaboration. I'd like to hear from our witnesses how they intend to make partnering with the U.S. government easier so we can more effectively leverage the ingenuity of U.S. farmers and agricultural experts. We've got the best food producers in the world, and we've got the tools. Let's use them to full advantage. The challenges are immense, but the imperative is clear. The United States can and must lead the way in promoting global food security. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on how we do that more efficiently and effectively. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator Rich, I just really want to thank you for those opening comments. I agree. We need to look for more efficient ways to deal with the scarce resources that are available. We'll never have enough resources to meet all the needs, and we have to figure out how to do that in the most efficient way. And your point about good governance is absolutely essential as part of the solution to these problems. And this is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Diplomacy is absolutely critical to avoid conflict, which also deals with these issues. So I appreciate very much the manner of your opening statement. Well, we have two very distinguished witnesses. I want to welcome both of you to the committee. Your full statements will be made part of our record without objection. And you'll have 5 minutes to sort of summarize your comments, and we will then get engaged in a question and answer format. We'll start with Ms. Dina Esposito. She is the assistant to the administrator of USAID's Bureau of Resilience, Environment, and Food Security. She also serves as Feed the Future Deputy Coordinator for Development and USAID's Global Food Crisis Coordinator. She has demonstrated a deep commitment to helping those impacted by food insecurity throughout her career. Previously, she served as the director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace, which she managed the delivery of life-saving food assistance across the globe. She also worked with Mercy Corps, where she guided food security and economic development in over 40 countries. Quite a record. I also want to welcome Dr. Gary Bauer, who is the Department of State Special Envoy for Global Food Security. Throughout his career, Dr. Fowler has been at the forefront of in integral achievements in agricultural development. He has worked extensively with the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and is a founder of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, a facility that I had the opportunity to visit above the Arctic Circle. That's a landmark achievement for global food security that holds the world's largest collection of agricultural biodiversity. As special envoy, Dr. Fowler has spearheaded the Vision for Adapted Crops and Soil, a program that works in partnership with the FAO and the African Union to address food security through the cultivation of healthy soils and diverse climate-resilient crops. We'll start with Ms. Esposito.
Thank you, Chairman Cardin, Ranking Member Risch, and the distinguished members of the committee, so many of you longtime champions for the world's hungry and impoverished. I also want to thank Special Envoy Fowler for his focus on strengthening indigenous food production through his vision for adapted crops and soil. After more than a decade of progress fighting chronic hunger and malnutrition after the 2009 global food crisis, a series of unprecedented shocks have reversed many of our gains, including COVID-19, Putin's brutal invasion of Ukraine, ongoing conflicts in Sudan, Ethiopia, Yemen, and now Gaza, and unprecedented consecutive droughts, most notably in the Horn. This miserable confluence means that today, 735 million people are chronically hungry. Every night they go to bed hungry because they can't afford enough to eat. That's 120 million more than in 2019, pre-COVID. 140 million people in the most vulnerable countries are acutely hungry. They are victims of conflict or compound crises that have upended their livelihoods, and they must depend on humanitarian assistance to survive. That number is twice as high as it was in 2019. Nevertheless, the committee and every American should know their generosity has kept millions of people off the knife's edge. At the height of the global food crisis in 2022, USAID was able to provide nearly $20 billion in humanitarian assistance, of which $6 billion was for emergency food assistance. Beyond making our dollars stretch further in emergency situations, we must continue investments that we know prevent hunger in the first place, investments that have had meaningful success. In the areas where Feed the Future, the U.S. government's signature global hunger initiative, has worked, poverty, hunger, and child stunting all declined by 20 to 25% in its first decade of work. But we do not rest on these results. When Congress took the extraordinary measure of providing an additional $1 billion in supplemental funds to Feed the Future in 2022, a doubling of our annual budget and the first increase in funding since 2009, we undertook a massive effort to harness Feed the Future to feed the present. As food prices hit record highs following Putin's invasion of Ukraine, we rushed to get high-quality seeds, fertilizer, and financing to the markets and into the hands of some of the world's poorest farmers, helping absorb the worst effects of the food crisis by strengthening local production. This complement to humanitarian assistance was critically important decision made by the U.S. Congress. The National Security Supplemental passed by this chamber last month includes $50 million to prevent and respond to global food insecurity. As the House hopefully takes up this critical package of assistance for our allies, it is important that humanitarian and development assistance remain a key component alongside security assistance. To make every dollar stretch farther, we are working harder than ever to leverage private sector investment with our limited development dollars, crowding in $700 million of private capital in 2022. By tapping into the expertise and supply chains of companies like J.R. Simplot from Idaho or McCormick Spices in Maryland, we are helping open new markets for American businesses and smallholder farmers at the same time. We also partner to generate and scale innovation with a special focus on women, who often comprise the majority of farmers where we work and yet lack access to the same information and services as men. These efforts connect us to 70 partners in the United States across 42 states in 16 innovation labs. And we're doubling down on Feed the Future's core mandate, which is to concentrate bilateral investments in several countries that we know are most in need and best poised for regional agricultural-led economic growth. Already, we have identified a subset of Feed the Future target countries in Southern Africa that, with adequate investment, we feel could give rise to a new regional breadbasket for the continent. While we're heartened by the progress we've made and optimistic about what our reforms will yield, we should again be clear-eyed about the circumstances the world faces. A strong El Nino weather pattern has fueled weather disruptions that are spiking needs in some parts of the world. Just last week, Zambia declared a national emergency following a month without rainfall. And in Gaza, the entire population, from some 2.2 million people, is facing at least crisis levels of acute hunger. Administrator Power just returned from the region, where she joined President Biden, Secretary Blinken, and other administration officials in continuing to stress the importance of expanded humanitarian access as part of an overall sustained effort to scale up the amount of life-saving aid we're getting into Gaza. After decades of progress, the downturn in global food security and nutrition security is indeed concerning. But the truth is, without American leadership and continued bipartisan support, it would be far worse. Looking forward, bending the hunger curve downward will require us to better anticipate rather than only react to future shocks and continue to make long-term agricultural investments, enhancing our own economic well-being and fostering a safer and more secure world in the process. Thank you for your continued partnership, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Dr. Fowler?
Chairman Cardin, Ranking Member Risch, distinguished members of the committee. Notwithstanding a dramatic decrease in media attention, we still face a global food crisis. Conflict, extreme weather, supply chain disruptions are major factors, and there are others. Food systems are complex. Everything from farm to fork has to operate as it should. Thus, there are many components to address if food insecurity is to become food and nutrition security. At the food production stage, there are conditions that every farmer wants and needs. Good fertile soils and appropriate fertilizers. Seed varieties that are adapted to the environment, the climate, and the market. Water. And functioning markets and access to those markets. Trade is critical. The majority of countries in this world are net food importers. We live in a highly interdependent world. What happens in one small country, one small corner of the world, a conflict, a drought, a crop pest, a poorly thought out policy, rarely stays there. Early in my career, the failure of the anchovy crop off the coast, western coast of South America was, believe it or not, one of the major triggers of a global food crisis. Everything seems to be connected. Historically, the most successful way of increasing food production was to increase cropland. But in the 1980s, for the first time, global per capita food supply increased without an increase in cropland. We thus entered into a new era where producing more with less sustainably became the imperative. There are many challenges to overcome. We have a clear and pressing humanitarian reason for wanting to try. We also have self-interest. We all want to live in a peaceful world. The problems associated with global food insecurity are beyond what any individual country can solve or be expected to solve. But the way we choose to engage makes a difference. The United States is in a unique position to lead. This is an area of comparative advantage for us. It's where our strength lies. We can lead with programs such as the Feed the Future program and others that you'll hear about today. We can lead with technology, with research, and good old-fashioned know-how. We can lead with analysis and strategy. We can lead with diplomacy. Most of all, perhaps, we can lead with ideas, with our American values, and with our commitment. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony. I'm going to start the round of questioning with the point, Dr. Fowler, that you concluded and that is conducting on our values. Autocratic governments have an asymmetric arsenal to attack our democratic systems of government. We saw in Russia's case the use of oil and gas as a weapon of war to try to intimidate other countries. We now see that in regards to grain. They have disrupted Ukraine's grain exports. We've made some progress in that regard, thanks to the international efforts and the courage of the Ukrainians. But the grain supply from Ukraine has been very much disadvantaged. Russia, on the other hand, has increased their exports over the last 3 years by about 30% in its grain, offering it, particularly in Africa, at low cost or, in some cases, free. So I just really want to get your view as to how what Russia is doing in Ukraine and the use of its grain diplomacy, how that's affecting the stability of the world's food supplies and, again, making Russia more aggressive in their use of this weapon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, Ukraine was one of the top five exporters of a number of important commodities. Russia is also a top exporter. And you're correct that that Russia has seized some of the market that they, in fact, have destroyed for the Ukraine. The exports in Ukraine are up year over year, but I think it's always a little bit problematic to compare 1 year to the previous year because of the kinds of differences that occur in production year over year. What we can see is that production in the land area in Ukraine devoted to agriculture is down from pre-war and pre-COVID levels. I think when I've taken a look at what Russia has done in Ukraine, it, of course, has been really hard to fathom the kind of destruction that's been wreaked on that country and the impact that that's had globally. Yes, markets adjust price-wise, but what we can't adjust to is the decrease in the production coming from that war in Ukraine. It is a crime against and a war on food security. I'll just note that in all of my many years of working in this area, I've been privileged to see a number of projects and initiatives that the United States has undertaken in developing countries in recent years through the Feed the Future program, for example. I have never in all of my years actually seen a Russian agricultural development project in a developing country. Perhaps they exist. I haven't seen them.
Ms. Esposito, I want to call out how our other countries in the world are responding to this crisis. U.S. is the largest donor nation. I know other nations are doing incredibly important work in regards to this crisis. Other countries are not. Can you just give us a report of where we can be more effective in putting a spotlight on those countries that should be doing more in regards to this crisis?
Thanks, Senator Cardin, for that question. You are right that we see the United States continuing to lead on the humanitarian response, covering roughly 45% of the UN World Food Program's budget. We continue to call for more support from around the world to support the UN World Food Program. On the development side of the house, I think we're seeing some glimmers of new partnerships that are trying to address some of the underlying causes of the food crisis. Secretary Vilsack and USDA are leading a global call to action to invest urgently in more climate-resilient crop research, and they have generated over 500 partner commitments from other governments and from the private sector, some $17 billion of commitment. So we want to continue to use those kinds of platforms to drive more support, likely in also in Agri-Ukraine. In the Ukraine, we continue at AID to call on partners to join us in supporting the farmers of Ukraine to get seeds, fertilizer, and finance. And so we can use our all forums and our voice and your voice to call on other countries to support these kinds of efforts on the development side, as well as the humanitarian side, in the hope that we can mitigate some of the overall impact of the crisis.
That was a very diplomatic answer, but not really responsive to my question. What I'm going to ask that you supply to us are the numbers,
okay,
so that we can see what countries are doing. We'll make our own judgments based upon that. But there are certainly countries that should be doing a lot more, and we believe in putting spotlights on those countries. It's one thing for us to ask our taxpayers to do more, and we do, and to get more resources. But it's also important that the global community respond to the food crisis that we have, and we need to have from you the objective information so we know where to put our attention. Senator Risch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Esposito, let me ask of you first. You know, we've got countries that are facing hunger and food insecurity at a very, very high level, but also are accompanied in those same countries with endemic corruption perpetrated at really the highest levels. And a couple of poster children for that are Zimbabwe and South Sudan. I wonder if you could talk for a few minutes about how USAID ensures that our efforts to improve ag and food security are accomplished without contributing to the corruption. I mean, look, we're all trying to do the right thing here, but I'll tell you, it is tough when you run into these kinds of examples. So can you talk a little bit about that, and as specifically as you can?
Thank you for the question. The Feed the Future portfolio has really tried to prioritize countries that we think have the commitment to invest in their own agriculture, as well as the opportunity to drive economic growth. So places like Tanzania, which has tripled its investments for agriculture in the last year, and other countries, Zambia, Malawi, Kenya, which are investing in their own future. In all cases, whether it be the places like Sudan or Zimbabwe or these other countries, we are relying on international partners. We're not giving money directly to governments, and we are creating, as you know, very rigorous risk mitigation efforts and safeguards that we're working with our partners to help ensure that the money is used exactly for its intended purposes. I would also say that one of the priorities of Feed the Future is to work on policy reform and regulatory reform. Often some of the challenges that we see when Special Envoy Fowler and I were going around Southern Africa is that we really do have an opportunity to influence governments through our policy agenda to catalyze private sector investment, to accept improved seeds, to open regional trade. And so we're trying to use our influence in a way that would actually improve the overall context without contributing to further corruption.
Well, I appreciate that. And certainly those efforts are laudable and need to be doubled down, because there's nothing more frustrating than trying to do the right thing and then seeing things wind up in the wrong hands. Dr. Fowler, I want to talk with you for a few minutes about another thing that's very frustrating, and that's the U.S. cargo preference requirements. I think we really believe that these make food aid delivery through the Food Peace and Food for Peace and Emerson Trust programs too slow and too expensive. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I'll have to apologize. Now,
I understand it's a political issue, and so I'll give you the leeway you need there to answer the question.
Yeah. Senator, that's an issue that probably is handled a little bit more in detail by my colleagues from AID. I'm afraid I haven't gotten into that.
Ms. Esposito, do you have anything to contribute to that?
Thank you, Senator Risch. I'm familiar with the cargo preference requirements from my time working in the Office of Food for Peace. I can say that at present, the USAID is able to comply with cargo preference requirements while meeting its humanitarian mandate. But you do know that increased costs for ocean transport on U.S. flag vessels does come at the expense of reaching more people. Today, we estimate it's about twice as much to move bulk cargo on U.S. flagged ships than other ships, and they don't always go to the locations that we require.
When President Biden ordered an extraordinary drawdown of the Emerson Trust in April of 22, it took 12 months and $388 million to transport $282 million worth of food. And unfortunately, this is not the exception, it's the rule. This is really frustrating when you're talking about spending more money than what you're actually delivering to get it there. What can we do about this?
I think that right now we know that there are individuals looking to change the cargo preference one way or another, and we really do want to both support our American farmers where it's appropriate and also meet our humanitarian mandate. So as the current bill is current, as the law is currently written, we're finding that we can do both of those things, but recognizing we could certainly do more if there were further flexibility in this regard.
My time's up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member, and thank you both for your focus on this at the full committee level and for your partnership. And I couldn't agree more with the Ranking Member that we have worked, many of us, for many years on cargo preference to improve efficiency. Senator Corker and I tried and tried over many years. Senator Johans previously. So I do think real progress has been made in delivering food assistance directly. The availability of cell phones and individually identifying information makes transparent and efficient transfer of resources to hungry refugees around the world far more easy and far more efficient than it's ever been before. The folks who are protesting here and who've been outside my house every weekend are focusing, understandably, on the severe humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But I want us to take one moment and focus on the numbers that Ms. Esposito put in front of us in her opening statement. 735 million people across the world chronically hungry, 140 million acutely hungry, double the number in 2019. There's roughly 2 million people in Gaza. And we need to do more to deliver timely humanitarian aid. I was just in the region in Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and elsewhere, meeting with the UN-related relief organizations and talking with leaders in Israel about how we do a better job of that. But that's for 2 million people. Around the world, there's 140 million people chronically hungry. And so while we do remain focused on the challenges in Ukraine and Gaza because of conflict, we also have to be mindful of other conflicts around the world, like Sudan, like Armenia, like Somalia, like Yemen, which continue to put literally whole nations at risk because of food insecurity. And I urge members of the House to take up and pass the President's supplemental that includes $9 billion for humanitarian aid. But to the point both the Chair and Ranking made at the outset, and to the core point, Dr. Fowler, of your whole work, your vision for adapted crops and soils, we have to make investments in being more efficient, in improving food systems, in having seeds and soils and systems that meet this moment. So even at this moment, this late date, I am fighting in the Appropriations Committee to ensure that $50 million you referenced, Ms. Esposito, and more efforts at deploying the private sector come into play. So I have two questions I wanted to make sure we got to. First, Africa has the ability to feed itself if we get food systems aligned. A country like Angola, where I'm going soon, imports 80% of its food. A country like Zambia, which is going through a drought, could be the breadbasket of the whole region. The global food security strategy has had a huge impact on smallholders and SMEs, but we need to do more to mobilize the private sector, which is the engine of opportunity for post-farm gate, for everything that is grown and produced on a farm then leaves and has to be processed and stored and distributed. Do you agree we need to do more to support emerging investment opportunities, as you referenced, Ms. Esposito, for larger scale agribusiness that can complement smallholder farms and to rationalize and modernize the farm systems of the developing world?
Thank you for the question, Senator. Increasing public-private partnerships is actually at the forefront of the new global food security strategy. It's always been important to us. We generated $700 million in leveraged private sector money in 2022, and we're aiming for closer to $900 million in the coming years. Some of the examples of that work, Special Envoy Fowler and I saw in Zambia, where an American company, Pyxis Agriculture, was working with an innovation lab, an American innovation lab, to develop improved seeds, both soybean varieties that were quadrupling yields for some farmers, as well as peanut varieties. They, in turn, we have invested in helping to de-risk their investment, and they, in turn, are using over 150,000 farmers to contract farm. So there you have a really nice linkage between smallholder farmers and the goals and ambitions of commercial agriculture. The same
I'm
is
about
true.
To go to Zambia, yeah. And I look forward to right. talking with you in more detail about that, if I could, with the forbearance of the chairman. Senators Graham and I have introduced legislation to create an international foundation for food security. The whole point of it is to provide blended financing tools that would catalyze investment, not to compete with Feed the Future, but to complement it. Do you think that blending financing tools, credit, risk insurance, first loss guarantees, could help scale your efforts, and Dr. Fowler, complement your efforts with smallholder farmers to leverage larger agribusiness investments?
Thank you for the question. We are really grateful to you, Senator Coons and Senator Graham, in the fight against hunger, your vocal protestations on the state of the world, and your leadership in constantly looking for new ways of doing business. We are really fortunate to have your passion and engagement on this. We have provided some general comments, and we, in general, are very supportive of the vision behind the Global Food Security Foundation bill. We really would like to sit down. We haven't had a chance to sit down with all of you and go through the details so that we can really work on ensuring that things are mutually reinforcing and complementary. But certainly this idea that we can do more to crowd in private sector is absolutely on point, and we think there's a way to connect these two efforts for leverage.
That'd be helpful. We're looking for a vehicle that will survive across several administrations and put in place long-term blended finance opportunities. Mr. Chairman, would you allow Dr. Fowler to briefly answer? Doctor.
Thank you. I'll be brief. The programmatic elements that you mentioned are indeed some of the missing pieces that we often see in Africa and other continents for scaling up the kinds of technologies we have and for getting the private sector involved. So those are important things to highlight. Thank you for doing so.
Well, I'd look forward to a chance to meet with both of you to hammer out some of the details to make sure we can move forward in a timely way. Thank you for your forbearance, Mr. Chairman. And thank you to both of our witnesses for your very long, engaged, determined, and effective advocacy on behalf of the world's hungry. It's great to see both of you. Thank you.
Senator Shaheen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is probably first for Dr. Fowler, because in your closing comments, you talked about the way we choose to engage makes a difference to the world, and that we can lead with diplomacy. But one of the areas where the United States is not positioned to help is where we don't have ambassadors on the ground who can advocate. And as Senator Coons just pointed out so eloquently, there are more than 140 million people on the African continent facing acute food insecurity. Without addressing that, we'll see the number of displaced people across the African continent increased. It's already 40 million. But we don't have an ambassador to the African Union. We don't have ambassadors in eight other countries on the continent where food insecurity, many of them where food insecurity is a real issue. How, and by the way, in those countries, our adversary, our biggest competitor, the People's Republic of China, do have ambassadors who have been on the ground operating. So can you talk about how the absence of our ambassadors hinders our ability to respond to the needs of our partners with respect to food security?
Thank you, Senator. You're indeed correct. We have gotten a tremendous amount of support from our missions in Africa. They are hampered when the leadership at the top when an ambassador is not present. And you're correct in saying that China is quite active in Africa. We've seen that. One of the issues that really troubles me the most is that we, in Africa, 80% of the people in sub-Saharan Africa cannot afford a nutritious diet. There are a number of causes behind that, but this is an area where we need leadership, both from here in Washington, but also on the ground through the missions to make the kind of programs that my colleague, Ms. Esposito, has mentioned actually function properly. And I would also take the opportunity to mention that in the last 50 years, our public sector agricultural R&D budget, inflation adjusted, is about the same as it was 50 years ago today. In the interim, China has far outpaced us in its public sector R&D funding. I think it went from less than 1% in 1980 to now 23 or 24%. We are less than 20. This has historically been our comparative advantage, and so much of the agricultural research and development that we've done, both aimed towards developing countries, but also internally in the United States, has inured to the benefit of Africa and other developing countries. We need to keep up that comparative advantage as well.
I would certainly agree with that. And I failed to point out, as I was talking about the lack of ambassadors in Africa, that sadly what's holding up those ambassadors are our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. Ms. Esposito, despite women playing a crucial role in feeding their families in the world, they often eat last and they eat least. In fact, last year, 84.2 million more women and girls were hungry than men and boys worldwide. So can you talk about how USAID structures the food security programs to try and address that disparity between men and women and what we're doing to help ensure that women are engaged in all aspects of food insecurity?
Thank you, Senator. You're right in your concern. There was a very disturbing report by FAO last spring on women in agri-food systems, which said that despite our efforts, they still produce 24% less food on their lands. They still have less access to finance, less access to information, and other tools. And one of the things we've done is to increase our commitment significantly within Feed the Future, and we've made a public commitment at the launch of that to reach no less than $350 million of our portfolio each year, focusing on closing that gap. We've set top-line targets to reach parity on finance for men and women in our programs, and also to improve women's dietary diversity. Our job is to increase the food supply and get safe, healthy, affordable food on the market. Our global health colleagues are very focused on exclusive breastfeeding and supplements, and our humanitarian colleagues are focused on the treatment and prevention of moderate and acute malnutrition. It takes all of those things together, not just the Feed the Future program or health, to get it's this really intractable issue on both unleashing the potential for women and improving nutrition.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you both for the work that you're doing. Did you want to respond, Dr. Fowler?
Thank you. I'd love to respond. One of the things that really breaks my heart on this subject is the degree of childhood stunting. Stunting is where the height is right, inappropriate for the age, and there are 150 million children under the age of 5 who are stunted. That's a physical stunting. It's a mental stunting. It lasts for the rest of the life. It's impossible for me to imagine how countries with very high stunting rates, 20-30% of the children under 5, are going to develop economically and otherwise with that kind of situation. One that has driven by our program called VAX, the Vision for Adapted Crops and Soils, where we're focusing on traditional and indigenous crops in Africa. We've identified the ones that have the most potential for nutrition. Most of those crops have historically been tended by women, and they're nutrition dense. So if we want to get at the problems that you raised, and if we want to address really directly the problem of childhood stunting, we empower women by empowering and increasing the productivity of the crops that they grow to address those macro and micronutrient problems.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for your work.
Senator Booker.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member, I want to thank you for having what I think is an urgently important committee hearing, and I want to thank our witnesses who have such extraordinary careers of serving this country and, frankly, making a difference in the lives of millions of human beings across the planet, and I'm just deeply grateful. I want to reiterate your question, Ms. Garden, that you didn't quite get an answer to. Maybe we can write just about how opportunistic it is for us, or the opportunities that are presented to us to engage with leaders from other countries, from the Middle East to Europe, to be able to know which countries to really target in our conversation about raising their burden. We had an extraordinary meeting. Senator Coons was there with ambassadors from European Union, and really a frank conversation about the resources that they can do, and a shift of millions of dollars one way or the other. We know what it makes a difference on the ground. So any in writing, any kind of help you can give us with that. I want to reiterate what Senator Shaheen said, perhaps not for you all, but having just come back from East Africa, and seeing the difference that leadership makes, not having ambassadors in Djibouti, not having ambassadors in Somalia. I mean, it is powerful how much an ambassador makes a difference in the details of negotiating with countries who find it a sign of disrespect when we have these positions vacant. And for us not to have a leader in the African Union is absolutely absurd at this point. And then finally, for some of my questions, I just want to get back to where Senator Coons was leading with his questions, because I think it's so important. You know, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization is, to me, I've learned in over the last years how critical it is. It works with the World Food Program, but FAO typically focuses on longer-term activities detailed by my friend Senator Coons. You know, it provides technical expertise on agricultural sustainability, market access, and really the returns on that in the long run are profoundly staggering to me when it comes to longer-term solutions of problems that we can empower countries to deal with. Every dollar spent to protect rural livelihoods can save around $10 in food-related assistance for displaced families. And by doing that, you're not only supporting agricultural resiliency and strength in the future, you're undermining what often becomes economic conditions that lead to instability and to extremism. So I don't even think that $1 invested to $10 return is anywhere near the truth of what it does. And despite the evidence that investing in long-term food resiliency programs pays these incredible dividends, saves U.S. taxpayers money, we don't prioritize it in the way that I think, given the results. So this is just an example. In fiscal year 2023, the United States contributed about $5.9 billion to the World Food Program, thanks to the efforts of my colleagues, the leadership of this committee. But in the same fiscal year, we only contributed $110 million to the Food and Agricultural Organization. And so that, to me, is very stunning. And I was wondering, Dr. Fowler, how do you and your view this policy imbalance towards long-term food insecurity?
Thank you, Senator. This is a difficult question that perhaps philosophers should engage in as well as people like us. I think we have to realize that food aid is not the same thing as food security. And one of the difficult realities that we have to face is that the gap between what we can and are willing to supply in terms of humanitarian assistance and what is needed on the ground is growing. And one need only look at the WFP budget for this year versus previous years and the need that they're trying to address to understand that. You're certainly correct that an ounce of prevention is worth a lot of cure. And part of the thing that I think we need to be mindful of is that the type of long-term investments that are necessary for driving productivity, not just in the United States, but abroad, are investments that we really need to make. There was a report that was done for BIFAD, the Board for International Food and Agricultural Development for USAID, just a few years ago, that pointed out that the agricultural R&D budget that is of ours that is focused on foreign agricultural research and development actually pays net benefits to U.S. farmers. And sometimes the cost-benefit ratio of this, or overall the cost-benefit ratio of R&D, domestic and foreign, is tremendous, 10 to 1, 30 to 1. So these are the types of investments that pay off both abroad, lower the incidence of the tensions and contribute to having peace and stability, but they're also the kinds of investments that pay off for U.S. farmers.
This is a conversation I want to have more. My time's expired. There are folks waiting. But I just want to say for the question for the record, Ms. Esposito, last November, myself and multiple senators on this committee wrote a letter to the Administrator Power where we asked for common sense efficiency reforms to reach more kids with acute malnutrition. I'm hoping that I can get your commitment to work with the staff to get actually an update on where we stand. I want to just say as forcefully as I can, the supplemental that's coming up, it is staggering to me that there are people suggesting in the House of Representatives to strip out the $9-plus billion dollars in humanitarian aid. From Afghanistan to Lebanon to Jordan, having just returned from Jordan now, if we do not put humanitarian aid there, these nations that are critical for stability in the Middle East region could plunge into instability, causing us a greater need for military intervention and more. I also want to emphasize, having just come back from the continent and going again in 2 weeks, that if we do not get resources into countries, humanitarian resources, and amidst this great power competition with China, we are so undermining our future interest on the continent. And given that we, from Sudan to the Horn to the DRC, the urgency of those resources as investments now to save us necessary military investments or losing ground to the Chinese, it's just unconscionable. So I just want to make that point that the food and humanitarian assistance resources are utterly critical going forward. And I thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Booker, I agree with your point. The numbers that we've gotten so far with other countries, as you point out, the United States is the largest contributor to the World Food Program, giving multi-billions of dollars every year. PRC is at 13.7 million, and we're in the billions. Russia at 71 million. Madagascar and Burundi give more money than PRC to the World Food Program. So there is a real attention here that we need to know. We'll get the specific numbers from all countries. The Europeans are doing better, but they could do more. So I thank you for raising those issues. We're up to Senator Ricketts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ranking Member Risch, and thank you for our witnesses here to testify and take your time today. Water and food security are two of the most pressing issues facing the world today. With a growing population, growing demand for resources, and increasing disruptions to water and food systems, it is vital to find sustainable and practical ways to overcome these challenges. The University of Nebraska's Doherty Water for Food Global Institute is uniquely positioned to advance water management for greater food security. By leveraging the world-class research at the University of Nebraska, the state's expertise in agriculture and water resource management, and private sector partnerships, the Institute is making progress on a more water and food secure future. In October 2023, the Institute received a $19 million grant from USAID to lead a global collaboration aimed at developing irrigation mechanization for small farmers in developing countries. This partnership focuses on technical aspects of irrigation and issues crucial to long-term successes such as workforce development, installation, maintenance, and more. Ms. Esposito, How can USAID continue to address the global challenges of water availability and drought resilience through investments and partnerships with innovative organizations like the Doherty Water for Food Global Institute at the University of Nebraska?
Thank you, Senator, for the question, and I'm just delighted that Nebraska is now part of the Innovation Labs. We're very much looking forward to them joining the 16 Innovation Labs around the world. The focus on irrigation and mechanization is absolutely vital as we try to boost agricultural production in a changing climate. And we know, in fact, that in extremely low-income countries, women and youth in particular, and other marginalized groups, many of them who are on the forefront of producing more food, are not getting the benefits of that small-scale irrigation and mechanization. So we really are looking forward to the research and the advice of the university in terms of how we can scale that to many, many more women and young people who are going to be the future of agriculture.
So, and as you know, as you're aware, farmers in developing nations oftentimes have difficulty adopting irrigation technology. It's due to a number of factors, including a lack of technological expertise, quality workforce, cultural barriers. How is USAID working to create a buy-in with local communities and producers to ensure irrigation infrastructure is not only utilized but maintained throughout its life cycle?
You're right, Senator. It's one thing to introduce a new technology. It's another thing to scale and maintain it. I would have to get back to you on the details on how our how AID is working on that.
Well, Nebraska is the home to some of the world's largest irrigation companies, which deliver innovative solutions for food production around the world. So perhaps some of those companies can do it. It is critical to support the development of irrigation infrastructure to allow developing countries' food systems to sustain themselves. About 80% of all the world's center pivot irrigation equipment is actually manufactured in Nebraska. Has USAID got something similar to the Water and Energy for Food program that allows U.S. irrigation companies to engage in the innovation ecosystem with USDA programs?
We have a very strong team of people working on public-private partnerships, and we would be delighted to meet with or speak with those irrigation companies and see how we can sync up their innovations with our global footprint.
Yeah, that'd be great. Again, there's a lot of innovation going on in the state of Nebraska. We're the largest irrigated state in the country. We actually have more irrigated acres than even California. And even while having large irrigation, because of our system of water management, which is also goes into the regulatory side, which I think USAID should be paying attention to as well, we have managed to keep the Ogallala Aquifer within 1 foot of where it was in the 1920s, or 1950s, rather. So even while we're irrigating more, we're also finding ways to innovate to be able to produce more food with less water and keep the groundwater at a stable level. So I think there'd be a lot of benefit if you all looked at working with our irrigation companies on some of these technologies and to see how it might be adapted to different countries that aren't going to be able to have the big center pivots, but other sorts of irrigation technologies that would be able to be taken advantage of those developing nations.
Great. We welcome that offer, and we look forward to speaking with you more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Van Hollen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank both of you for your service and for your testimony. As this hearing has highlighted, we have desperate hunger around the world. Over 300 million people are facing acute levels of food insecurity this year. The conditions are particularly dire in Sudan, South Sudan, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Also, situation only slightly better in Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and other countries. But today I do want to focus on the situation in Gaza because, according to all reports, 4 out of 5 of the hungriest people in the world today live in Gaza. And this is clearly a man-made crisis. There was no real food insecurity in Gaza until the last 4 months. We also have recently passed the grim threshold where people are not just on the verge of starvation, but over 15 kids have now died of starvation in Gaza. The UN's humanitarian coordinator put out an update on February 21st of this year, finding that the decline in the population's nutrition status is happening at a globally unprecedented rate, and that children in Gaza are being starved at the fastest rate that the world has ever seen, according to the UN Humanitarian Coordinator. I am very pleased to see both the President and the Vice President and the AID Administrator more recently make forceful comments about the need for the Netanyahu government to allow more aid into Gaza. 25 senators wrote to the President in early February laying out 5 specific steps that could be taken to do that. None of those steps have been implemented as of now. So, Ms. Esposito, if you could just make one thing really clear. The issue is not the lack of the U.S. or the World Food Program making food available to go into Gaza. Is that right? It's not a question of not enough being made available that's ready to go in. It's a question of it getting in and getting to people in need.
Thank you, Senator. I want to start by saying up front that my remit is on the development side, and all of the programs we had in Gaza have been suspended, of course, because of the conflict. But I do know that we do have great concern about the imminence of a famine and that our team is really working on getting more food in, especially for women and children, and that there is opportunity and available food to move in. I would also say, though, I think it's important to recall that the humanitarian food budgets, because of the supplemental, were up at $12 billion in 2022. They went down 35% in 2023. This year, without a supplemental, it'll be 50% of what we had in 2022. And while there is food to be moved, medicine and supplies to be moved, when that ceasefire comes into place and we can really flood the zone with food, it's going to be really, really important to get additional resources. Right now, our Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance is estimating that in some of the most difficult places in the world, from Ukraine to Sudan to South Sudan, 40 to 60% reduction in the amount of humanitarian food assistance the U.S. government can provide in the absence of additional resources.
I second the comments that Senator Coons made, and I'm sure the chairman probably emphasized and others that we absolutely have to get the humanitarian assistance from the supplemental to address these issues worldwide. Dr. Fowler, you're an expert on food security and nutrition, and I'd like for you just to talk a little bit about the long-term impacts of malnutrition and going without food for kids. UNICEF's Ted Chapon, who's the Deputy Executive Director for Humanitarian Action at UNICEF, pointed out, and I quote, that the international community has, quote, been warning for weeks that the Gaza Strip is on the brink of a nutrition crisis. If the conflict doesn't end now, children's nutrition will continue to plummet, leading to preventable deaths or health issues which will affect the children of Gaza for the rest of their lives and have potential intergenerational consequences. Do you agree that that can be a consequence of kids being deprived of nutrition?
Yes, I do. As you know, the UN has estimated that 90% of the population in Gaza continues to face acute food insecurity, and this has an impact first and foremost on children and of course women as well. We know that early interventions for childhood nutrition pay benefits for the entire life of the person. On the flip side of that, we know that long periods without sufficient food, without the necessary calories, micronutrients, macronutrients, this also can have lifelong consequences. I spoke earlier to this committee about the problem of stunting. So we believe that Israel must facilitate the delivery of assistance through crossings, improve the deconfliction procedures to ensure that aid can move safely and securely, and that restrictions that prevent the flow of life-saving food into Gaza are not acceptable.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Young.
I thank our witnesses for being here today. I'd like to explore how artificial intelligence technologies and their continued advancement intersect with this topic. Predicting food insecurity so that we can obtain and pre-position supplies has been a life-saving advancement in the field of humanitarian aid made during our lifetimes. The ability to build diverse supply chains for food stocks not only means on-time delivery of critical supplies, but also a widening humanitarian donor and supplier base, which itself helps to mitigate insecurity. Artificial intelligence enables humanity to fight food insecurity at every stage of development, automating R&D to design more resilient, high-yield seeds, optimizing and mapping yields throughout each growing season with autonomous tractors and drones, and predicting disruptions to enable a resilient supply chain that meets demand and saves lives. But AI's use as a predictive tool is only as good as the data it's trained on. An unprecedented disruption of global supply routes, be it through the Red Sea, Black Sea, or over overland, has direct consequences on food and ag availability. So to both of our witnesses, please give us a state of play, or in the absence of tangible examples, your assessment of how AI can and should be deployed to better predict both ag shortages due to issues like water scarcity, natural disasters, or quality of cropland, and global supply route disruptions and the cascading effect of logistical and transportation disruptions to food supplies for countries who heavily rely on imports.
I'll begin. Senator, thank you for that most interesting question. I think I'm too old to be an expert on AI. But we've recently had the occasion to use AI in some of our work with some interesting results. We, in the VACS program, the Vision for Adapted Crops and Soils, we focused on 60 traditional and indigenous crops in Africa that had a lot of potential for adding nutrition. There wasn't a lot known about those crops. We used AI and found, I think, an astonishing 180,000 pieces of information that otherwise couldn't have been found and that could now be assembled and used to map out where those crops can be grown, what kind of nutrition they can add. Similarly, on the soil side, I'll say that there is a huge challenge in Africa to map and model the soils of Africa. If you're going to have a productive and sustainable system of agriculture, you have to know, as a government, where your good soils are, where to promote agriculture, where not to, and what kinds of crops to promote. And as a farmer, what kind of practices to promote as well. We take that for granted in the United States. We have GPS-linked tractors and combines, for instance. That doesn't exist in developing countries. But using AI and other technologies, we can begin to model what satellite data we do have, model the soils without the necessity of going to each individual, sometimes 1- and 2-acre farm, to take soil samples and begin to give the farmers the kind of information that we take for granted here. And to your point about the quality of the data going into such a system, through cell phone use, through apps, you can get now, even in Africa, recommendations at the farm level of how you could best practice agriculture and use the soil information, but you can also feed back information into the system to improve it.
Thank you for your thoughtfulness. It was a long sort of lead-in to the question. You unpacked it, I thought, quite elegantly. So let me just ask you, since my time's somewhat limited, what, if any, resources from Congress could assist you in adopting AI technologies or integrating AI-supported predictions into your analysis of what may be the next food insecurity crisis? What should we do to help you?
Yeah.
And if you'd like to sort of take that question under advisement and get back with me, that's acceptable as well, because I think you will soon see members of Congress attentive to and poised to act as it relates to artificial intelligence across every area of policymaking. And the sooner we can incorporate some of the functionality of AI into decision making and other facets of alleviating food insecurity, I think probably the better.
Thank you. We'd be pleased to have a little time to think about that and get back to you.
Great.
Take the question.
Thank you.
Let me just acknowledge Senator Young's leadership on the AI issue and really challenging all of us, particularly every committee, to look within our jurisdiction as to how we can advance America's leadership on AI applications. And I must tell you, I never thought about AI in regards to dealing with world hunger. But clearly, there is a major role it can play. And if there's impediments by law in our international efforts, that's in our committee's jurisdiction. And we want to make sure when there's an opportunity to move an AI bill, which the leadership is very committed to doing, and Senator Young is playing a key role in that, that we address those issues. So, Dr. Fowler, if you will get back to us, not only to Senator Young, but our committee, if there's legislative issues that could be made more friendly towards the application of AI, and of course the resource issues are also very much within our committee's jurisdiction. So we would appreciate getting back. And Dr. Fowler, Senator Risch and I took a little bit of homage with your use of the age as affecting AI. Just want you to know that. Senator Kane.
Thank you. I'm going to ask most of my questions about Haiti, but I did want to ask one question about Gaza. My memory isn't what it used to be. I don't recall during my time in the Senate the U.S. doing significant airdrops of food. Is this unusual? When was the last time we did airdrops of food like this?
Having spent a good portion of my career on the humanitarian side,
At Mercy Corps,
but also as a member of the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, mm-hmm. one of the places where airdrops, unfortunately, became a mainstream part of the agenda was in South Sudan. Operation Lifeline Sudan, mm-hmm. During those war years, was a regular, unfortunately, and expensive way to address communities that were completely cut off. No roads, heavy rains, and so it became a seasonal activity, but it is always one of last resort. I do recall one in Syria as well when I was working on that, the start of the war there.
It's last resort, and when there's no access, no roads, et cetera, I mean, sometimes it's all you can do. Here is a space where there are roads, there are border crossings, there are access points, and I think that I'm glad we're doing the food airdrops, but I think much more should be done through traditional means delivery of food across the border. About Haiti, the situation in Haiti is just very, very grim. And I think there's some things that I hope we might do in this committee and in the Senate. We haven't had a confirmed ambassador to Haiti since 2021. Dennis Hankin was nominated in May of 2023, and we still haven't acted on that nomination. Second, we have approved funding for the multinational security force in Haiti that will be led by the Kenyans, but those dollars have not yet been released by the Senate. And I would just ask to the chair and ranking, I would love to work with you on this issue because it was extremely difficult to get the Kenyans to stand up and say they would lead a multinational security effort, and yet they did stand up because of the U.S. Indication that we would be providing funding for it. And that funding is withheld right now, and that really threatens whether the Kenyans will be able to do what they have agreed to do in tandem with the Haitian government. So I hope we can work on the committee, both on the getting an ambassador, but also on getting the multinational security support mission up and funded. Because this is not just about hunger and instability in Haiti. It's 700 miles from the United States, and we've seen some of the challenges around migration and immigration are driven by instability in Haiti. But turning to the
food security issue. The World Food Program says that food insecurity impacts about half the population in Haiti, making it one of the most food insecure countries in the world, certainly in the hemisphere. Rainfall deficit, flooding have damaged crops, and gang violence disrupts agriculture, trade, commerce, distribution of food. Can you share how the U.S. is working to counter these negative impacts and promote more food security in Haiti? And I would direct that question either to Dr. Fowler or Ms. Esposito.
Thanks. That's really sort of a two-part question in the sense that we have life-saving humanitarian aid going on through the Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance, working with the UN World Food Program to get food parcels out through pre-positioned sites, as well as nutrition interventions to help stave off acute malnutrition. On the development side, this is what we call a resilience-focused country, trying to work in places where you have high fragility, high risk of urgent humanitarian need, and we're trying to develop local markets and local food production to help Haitians grow their own food. And we're also working on water management commissions, so connecting the food security objectives and the water security objectives. And also working on fortified foods, wheat flour substitutions that have nutritional value. All of these programs tend to be taking place well outside the urban areas where most of the challenges right now are ongoing, although we know that area is spreading. It is a very dynamic situation. I would need to check to see if those programs are continuing at this point or whether because of insecurity. I know that the humanitarian piece is going on. The development portfolio is something I would have to get back to you on.
Dr. Fowler, could you comment on Haiti at all?
Sure. I'll just mention that Haiti is, in a sense, a poster child for the confluence of conflict and climate and the kinds of problems that combination can cause, both of which lead to national security issues for them and obviously for us. This is a sign of the kind of issues that we're going to be facing, I think, more and more in other parts of the world.
Even as I'm walking to the hearing today, there's news out about Haiti, about the instability of the current government and requests that the current kind of acting prime minister step down and what's the next step. This is a situation that is devolving. If it's possible for it to devolve, it's devolving pretty quickly even right now. And I hope that this is something that the committee might be able to turn our attention to.
Thank you. Senator Risch?
Senator Kane, The request for that funding, the Four Corners have signed off on. And I have to tell you, I had reluctance. And let me tell you my reluctance. Nobody told me what this is for. There needs to be a plan going forward. Your description of the situation, apparently the two prisons they have got attacked this weekend and they let thousands of prisoners out. So I don't know. We all want to do something about it, but somebody needs to tell us what the money's going to go for. You know, what a path forward is there for. And you've described the situation as bleak. I think that's probably an understatement of what's going on there.
The sign-off was for, I believe, $10 million, which was a partial amount. There's still additional resources that are needed for the Kenyans to be able to go into Haiti. But there are some legal issues in regards to they're going in. So this is an issue that we need to pay attention to. In regards to the ambassador, that has been approved by our committee. That's on the floor. So we have floor issues on bringing up nominations, something that we've talked about.
My hope would be, I was aware that some of the funding had been released and there had been sign-off for it. Senator Risch, you know, your question about how will the additional funding be used, obviously a very fair question. I mean, we're seeing this, you know, horrible devolution there. There are dollars available. The Kenyans have agreed to step up to provide some security that should be helpful. I just would hope the administration could work with us to provide answers to the questions you have, because if the Kenyans do not stand up this security force, nobody else has yet shown a willingness to take lead. So while we have somebody who is willing and they have their legal issues to work through, I hope we can get answers to your questions so that we can not lose the opportunity.
And your point is well taken about the fact that our interest, the United States' national interest, is concerned for our own security because they're so close. And with that kind of instability, we all know what they're going to do. Yeah. If you live there, you'd want to come to the United States. And so I think probably whoever's the administration, if they're going to come up with requests, they need to really tie it into how it helps our security here. So thank you.
Ms. Esposito, I understand you wanted to give some additional response in regards to Senator Young's question on AI. Your mic's not on. Yeah.
There's a lot of work and room for growth on the AI side, and we do have analytics teams that are working on a whole range of modeling, and I'd be happy to provide further details to him in writing. I do know that one of our innovation labs at Pennsylvania State is using AI now as part of our agenda to really help farmers cope with a changing climate. As it gets warmer and hotter, we see ever more pests and diseases emerging in farmers' fields, and we have AI tools that are being used. People can access them on their mobile phone to very rapidly identify what that pest or disease is and get immediate advice on how to treat it. That's a very practical kind of field-level example of the kind of, I think, really powerful transformation that AI can have when people have the power of that information right in their phone and don't have to wait for an extension worker to show up in some really remote place. You're going to have, I think, it's a really important area that we need to be looking more at.
The committee will keep the record open until close of business tomorrow, and for questions for the record that may be asked by members of the committee, we'd ask that you respond promptly to those questions. And we thank you very much not only for your being here today, but what you do every day to deal with this human rights challenge that we have globally. Clearly, U.S. leadership is indispensable. We need to do more, and we need to get others to do more. We had to find more efficient ways to do our work, and technology can certainly help us solve some of these challenges. With that, the hearing will be adjourned. Thank you all very much.